Broadcast is made possible by the U of I's Center for Advanced Study, whose MillerCom 2005 lecture series presents The Real Meets the Imagined, Northwest Coast Art, Claude Lévi-Strauss, and Surrealist by Marie Mosé, George A. Miller Endowment Visiting Professor, UIUC and Senior Researcher, CNRS, Laboratory of Social Anthropology, Paris, on Thursday, March 31st at 7:30 p.m. at Knight Auditorium in Spurlock Museum. For more information, go to www.cas.uiuc.edu. Programs on WILL are made possible in part by a grant from Christopher's Fine Jewelry Design, a gallery of imaginative jewelry and gifts in downtown Champaign, offering one-of-a-kind custom design, gemstone round tables, and conflict-free diamonds direct from Canada.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. On the program today, a conversation with writer Emily Rapoteau. Her short fiction has been awarded the Pushcart Prize and the Chicago Tribune's Nelson Algren Award. Her latest fiction is her debut novel, The Professor's Daughter. The novel is an exploration of race and assimilation, identity, and family. Let me share an excerpt from the description of the book. This is from the book's jacket. When Emma Beaudreau's older brother, Bernie, winds up in a coma after a freak accident, it's as if she loses a part of herself. All their lives, he has served as her compass, her stronger, better half. Bernie was brilliant when Emma was smart, charismatic when she was awkward, and confident when she was shy. Only Bernie was able to navigate, if not always diplomatically, the terrain of their biracial identity. Those sentences from the description of Emily Rapoteau's debut novel, The Professor's Daughter. I suspect this afternoon we'll talk about the issues the novel raises, as well as the act of writing and the work of writers. Of course, we'll talk with Emily about her influences and her life experiences. Listeners, I hope you'll join us. Your questions and comments are invited. You can join the conversation with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, if it would be a long-distance call, use the toll-free number 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Our guest, Emily Rapoteau, teaches creative writing at the City College of New York. She earned her MFA in creative writing from New York University, where she was a New York Times Fellow. Her stories have been published in Tin House, the Missouri Review, and The Best American Short Stories, 2003. Her novel, The Professor's Daughter, is published by Henry Holt. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Emily, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you for having me.
Sure. This book, as I understand it, grew out of a couple of short stories you wrote, Bernie and Me and Bernard Jr.'s Uncle Luscious. Were the characters in those stories characters you felt had more to say? They wouldn't let you go?
Yes, definitely. The first short story I wrote, which is the first chapter in the book, Bernie and Me, was the first thing that I wrote when I was at NYU getting my Master of Fine Arts. And it was kind of in response to that dictum that a lot of first writers are told, write about what you know. And so I wrote a story kind of loosely based on my family, and that was that story, and it won the Chicago Tribune's Nelson Algren Award, which was a surprise for me, and it got me enough attention that I got an agent out of that.
Wow.
But then I was very reluctant to continue writing along themes that were so personal and so close. Mm. So for the rest of my time at graduate school, I wrote stories that were a little more distant. The one that was in Best American Short Stories, for example, is about a mathematician from Iran. And I wrote a pirate story, which was published also. But those didn't really have the heart that Bernie and me had. So this agent who was interested in me asked me, are you working on a novel? And I lied and said yes, because I wanted to keep her interested, even though I only had a couple of short stories under my belt. Then when it came time to really sit down and think about conceiving a book, I returned to that idea because it seemed like it had the most energy and the themes were most prescient for me. So the second story in the book, Bernard Jr.'s Uncle Luscious, was a chapter that I wrote when I really buckled down and decided I want to concentrate on creating a book. And it was after I had finished graduating, finished the program at NYU, and graduated and suddenly didn't have deadlines anymore and was finding it really difficult to sit down and write. So I did one of these artist colonies. They're fabulous places all over the country, all over the world, in fact, which invite artists of different stripes to come, and they give you the gift of time, free from distraction, to just work on completing a project. And they feed you, and they give you a space to work that's separate from the space where you sleep. So the space I was working in was a studio in a converted dairy barn overlooking a cow pasture. And being in the relative south, started getting my mind working, thinking about what it might have been like for my father growing up in the South during the 1950s under Jim Crow. And I wrote that story in only 3 days with very little sleep, and it's pretty much intact as I wrote it. And that's not a feat that I've been able to accomplish since. Mm. And it hadn't occurred before, but there was something very special about that place that I was in. And once I wrote that story, the shape of the novel became apparent to me that it wasn't just a story about me and my struggles being a quote-unquote tragic mulatto, but it was a larger story about my family and my family history, and even larger than that, a kind of a national story. And that was liberating for me to realize that I could write from different perspectives, not just my own. I could get outside of my head and write from my imagination, thinking about what it might have been like for my father. Then he stopped being my father for me and became a fictional character because I was thinking about him as a child, as a boy, and I started caring for him as almost like a son. And pretty soon, the character who had been my mouthpiece in Bernie and Me stopped really being me, but I did feel like close enough to those characters that I needed to tell their story.
Yeah. I suppose in a sense, then you almost become maybe sister to Emma.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, something like that. I hadn't expressed it that way before, but yeah, she started feeling like not me, somebody like me, and very attached to me. So sister is a good way of putting it, actually. Mm.
How did Bernie and Me affect you as it emerged on the page back when you first wrote it in college, and then once you had the novel down in a manuscript? How did that feel?
How did it feel to have written a novel?
Yeah.
That grew out of that story?
Yeah. Let's go back to that idea of, you know, Bernie and Me. It was, at that point, it's still really personal.
Mm-hmm.
How did it affect you as it emerged on the page? What did it feel like to have said what you did in that short story?
I have to say, I'm not a writer who enjoys the physical act of writing. I find it pretty painful, especially when I'm writing from life or from emotions that are really close and personal. So it was difficult to write, and I'm thinking of this quote by Dorothy Parker that expresses how I feel about writing very well. She said something along the lines of, I hate to write, I love having written. And that's how I felt about that story. After I'd written it, I felt a little bit lighter.
Mm.
And it was the same after I'd finish the book and put it out into the world. I feel like the issues that I was grappling with through the act of writing the book, which were issues of not really belonging in a society that's very stratified by race and that insists upon pigeonholing people racially, and that can be very hard when you defy stereotype, as I do. I'm a very racially ambiguous person. If you see me, I look like I belong to any number of ethnicities or cultures, and I was always very troubled by this question that I get asked repeatedly in my life, which is, what are you? And growing up, I always felt like when I got that question, like people were so uncomfortable with me, well, there was something wrong with me. And after having written the book, which was in a way my attempt to both answer that question, what are you, and to undermine asking a question like that, after having written the book, I began to feel like, well, there's really nothing wrong with me. There's kind of something wrong with society, which insists on asking questions like that. So I felt very liberated after writing it. And in some ways, you know, I sold the book, the manuscript, maybe 2 years ago. And so now I'm being drawn back into the world of promoting it because it's just been published. But it's strange because I feel like I've grown up a lot. Through the act of writing it, I grew up a lot, and those issues are much less, they affect me much less than they used to, you know. I'm much more comfortable in my own skin than I was when I sat down and began writing Bernie and Me.
Do you still get that question?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Living in New York and...
Yeah. Well, living in New York, people speak to me in different languages all the time, and I'm pretty fluid in Spanish, so I can respond to them in Spanish. But if they're talking to me in Farsi or Greek or something like that, I have a harder time. And so now when people ask me, what are you, I'm a little bit more, like I said, I'm more lighthearted about it. I can say, don't worry about it.
Yeah.
Or I can say, well, what you really want to know is why I look the way I do. And that's because I have a black parent and a white parent. And that sort of puts the onus on the person for asking a question like that.
Yeah.
But the fact is that why I look the way I do is not really what I am. And so that sort of question, if you were to be asked that question, or anybody, it's a very existential question. What are you?
Mm-hmm.
One that you need a couple of years to answer, really, because it's an answer that would involve who your family is, and where you come from, and where you were raised, and what political events have shaped your thinking, and all of that business. And so I took a couple of years to write a book to answer that question. And so now that it's sort of answered, I feel like, I feel different.
Yeah. The poet Richard Rodriguez was a guest on another one of our programs here at WILL some time back, and he said something that has stuck with me. And I just love the way he put it. He said, you know, America is brown.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, so we got to get past that, you know, what are you? And rather, you know, ask the question, who are you?
Yeah,
And where are your people from?
Yeah, there's more respectful ways to ask questions like that. What's your background? Who are you? Certainly more interesting questions, I think, than ones that don't, ones that don't insist that they need an answer that's very black and white. That's true. We are brown.
Yeah.
And there's a part in my book where the narrator, Emma, who was sort of my mouthpiece, is kind of angry because she has a college roommate who is blonde-haired and blue-eyed and is constantly described as having classic American good looks. And Emma, the narrator, says, well, nobody would ever think to say that of me in spite of the fact that I wouldn't have resulted anywhere else. People always say I look like a foreigner, but I do feel that way. Like, well, I'm the classic American beauty, actually. because I wouldn't have resulted in many other places.
Yeah.
So.
Well, there are so many American beauties now.
That's true.
Wow.
That's true.
Yeah. Talk with us, if you would, about the relationship, about the brother and sister, Bernie and Emma, and their relationship.
Right. Well, they're very, very close, and Emma feels like he's pretty much the only person in her life who understands her. And he says something to her along the lines of, we're the same person. I wasn't really finished yet when I came. So you came along to finish me up. He sort of refers to her as if he's a part of her, like she's his rib or something. And so when he lands in a coma after this freak accident and isn't around anymore for her to talk to, she's incredibly lonely, and she's left in this emotional space where she has to struggle to kind of form her own identity, whereas before she completely identified with him to the point that they were almost the same person. And luckily, everybody keeps asking me, everybody's been asking me on my book tour about how much of the novel is autobiographical, and one thing everybody wants to know is, did you have a brother who was in a coma like that? Did you have a brother who died in that horrible way? And I'm lucky to be able to say no. I that's completely fictive. But that extreme emotional state of loneliness was one that I wanted to explore. Loneliness is something that I'd experienced, feeling alone in my skin, and so I kind of took it to soap operatic proportions by having the one person that she felt close with kind of stolen from her life. So she's in a place of extreme loneliness, and I thought that was a dramatically interesting place to depart from. So this business of him landing in a coma happens really at the beginning of the book.
Right.
And then the struggle becomes the narrative.
Yeah, that feeling of being so alone and so isolated is not only because her brother is now in a coma, but there is a distance. There's some growing into relationships she has to do with her father and her mother as well.
That's right. That's right. And for her, coming into her own sense of self and identity involves understanding more about her father's past, which has been kind of a secret in their family. And I think every family has its secret. And in the family, in my book, the secret involves the grandfather, which is the first Bernard. There's three Bernards. Bernard the first, the second, who is the father, the professor of the title, and the third, who is the one who winds up in a coma. And the first Bernard is sort of a mystery in the book. And the second Bernard, the father insists upon, or refuses, rather, to speak about him, so that his children, Emma and Bernie, are very curious about this man. Bernie, in particular, is curious about his namesake, but the father's kind of crippled about talking about him. And then we learn this is because the father, the first Bernard, was lynched, and there's a sense of shame and kind of horror, and also, how do you speak about such a thing? Really, it's not a story for children, so they don't learn of that, but are very aware that there's something wrong. Something that's affected their father psychologically and emotionally that carries through to their generation, and there's a sense of confusion and loss that they feel and experience without really understanding what it was that had happened. So for Emma, after she loses her brother, part of her sense of self involves that history.
Yeah. And also there's a distance between her and her mother.
Yeah, that's right.
Lynn.
Mm-hmm. Who I think is a character, in hindsight, who gets short shrift in the book.
It's a father-daughter.
It's a father-daughter story in the end. But there is a kind of a rift between them. And part of this is because Lynn stands outside of this kind of anger that the black and biracial characters in the book experience. She can't really tap into it in the same way, although she has her own.
She's got her own pain.
She's got her own pain and her own demons. It's sort of different.
Yeah. She's also got her own strength.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, let's go back to Bernard the second. Let's call him BJ to kind of keep it straight, because Bernie is Emma's brother, and then their dad is BJ. That's how he was called when he was growing up. BJ knows that something happened to his father, and the only inkling, or he only hears sort of about it in kind of a roundabout way when he's at the barbershop.
Right.
And, you know, one of the characters in the story, a wonderful character, Nan Zan,
mm-hmm.
She tells BJ, no, that's a story too ugly to pass on.
Right.
You're the beauty in the story. Let's keep an eye. Let's remember that.
Mm-hmm.
The stories that Emma's father, BJ, does here at the barbershop always just end with someone saying, it's too bad what happened to your daddy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where does that leave Emma's father? And you know, what are your thoughts? It's a different question. Let's just leave that first one on the table. Where does this leave Emma's father? Kind of, you know, neither here nor there.
Right. Obviously, he's very interested in the story of what's happened to his father. And he wants to know, but when these men in the barbershop keep saying it's, you know, that story's too ugly to talk about, and his Nan Zan says the same thing, he doesn't really feel at liberty to press them about it. He kind of accepts that it's a horrible story, and I think is scared of it, scared of the truth
mm-hmm.
of it.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a sense also in which he carries that kind of mystery and that kind of pain without really understanding it around with him. He feels like he's the product of something bad without really knowing why or how or what happened.
Yeah. What are your thoughts about family secrets?
Like I said, I think every family has one. And I do, I think that they really have long-reaching effects through generations, you know, whether it's, I don't know, a grandfather was a philanderer here or there and had this other child who's floating around and there's a whole other branch of the family, or I think every family has something like this, some kind of secret that everybody can feel, whether or not everybody knows what the secret is.
Hmm. And it's interesting, sometimes when the secret is revealed, it really packs a punch, and other times it feels like, why is this a secret?
Right. I think that's true.
What are we afraid of?
It could be a relief to find out whatever the secret is.
Yeah.
And sometimes you're right, it packs a punch, and it's a horrible thing to learn.
Yeah. Now, your grandfather was killed when your father was not yet born.
That's right.
How did you learn about that?
I didn't learn about it until I read something that my father had written. He has a slim book that came out called A Sorrowful Joy, and it was published. It's basically a series of lectures that he gave. I think he was supposed to speak at Harvard, and he gave this series of lectures on kind of his, sort of along the lines of his spiritual memoir. And in that, one of those lectures, he reveals his story. So I didn't really learn of it until I read this book. And he didn't really learn of it until he came of age. I think he was 18 or 20 or something like that before his mother sat him down and told him what had happened. And he'd grown up with his stepfather, not really knowing what had happened to his own father, who he was named for. So there was a sense, that was something I was drawing from my autobiography, this sense of secrecy. But I knew that because he had a different last name, the man I knew as my grandfather was not my blood grandfather, not my grandfather by blood. And I always had this sense, even from a very young age, that something so terrible had happened, and I sort of assumed in my imagination that he had been lynched, that my grandfather had been lynched. And years later, actually, maybe this was only a few years ago, while I was writing the book, my brother Charlie, who the character of Bernie is very loosely based upon, and I went to this exhibit is called Without Sanctuary. I don't know if it's come to the Midwest. I think it's making its slow circuit around the country. But it's an exhibit of lynching photographs.
Mm.
Excuse me. They're actually postcards.
Yeah.
You've heard of this?
Yes.
It's sort of this sick practice of photographing lynched men and then turning those photographs into postcards, and people actually sent them. And in this exhibit, they had mounted the postcards so that you could see the image, and then they'd kind of reproduced what was written on the back so that you could see what had been written, and that was hanging alongside the image. So it was really disgusting things people had written, like, hey, Cousin Jim, you missed a fine barbecue today.
Mm.
And you'd see in these pictures below the men hanging from the trees, there was a real carnival or almost picnic atmosphere, like you'd see children eating watermelon, and it was just so disturbing. And I, as many people did, felt physically ill after seeing this exhibit, and so did my brother. And we went to Central Park after seeing it and said, you know, we discovered that we'd both always had this sense, without having been told, that our grandfather was lynched. So seeing that exhibit felt very, very personal, and it made both of us very, very angry, and that was the response. And I think that response might have been, I'm not sure, but I remember looking at other people in the exhibit, looking at those postcards, at those photographs, some of whom were black and some of whom were white, and I remember thinking, my response to this is physical, I feel sick, but I also feel this sense of outrage and loss. And I'm not sure that the white visitors looking at these pictures are feeling this extreme sense of anger that I feel right now. I think maybe they might be feeling a sense of sadness and possibly even guilt. But that anger, I feel like that kind of anger is part of what it is to be black in America. And for that reason, this mother character that we were discussing, Lynn, I think that's one of the reasons why Emma and Bernie kind of feel a little bit detached from her and her experience, and why it's less central to the narrative that I was trying to tell, because the narrative I was trying to tell was also an exploration of that kind of rage that you carry. What do you do with that? Where does it come from? That kind of burden.
Mm. And that gives us Professor Lester Wright.
Mm-hmm.
He's very different from Bernard II, B.J.
That's right.
They have different world views, and they handle the anger and the identity issues very differently.
Right. They handle being black differently in the world. And Professor Lester he's kind of a, I enjoyed writing him very much. He's kind of a seductive character, I think. He's also a jokester, and he almost enjoys it when he's pulled over on the New Jersey Turnpike for being black, because he drives a Cadillac, and it's assumed that automatically that he's a pusher or a pimp. And he kind of enjoys it when he gets to pull out his Princeton University ID in front of the cop. And prove it. No, in fact, he's not a drug dealer, and he wasn't speeding. And actually, he's a professor who holds two Guggenheims. And whereas, if that were to happen to BJ, the father, the sense of outrage that he would feel is very different.
Yeah, he swallows it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he holds it inside. He kind of carries it with him everywhere he goes, and his children feel that.
Yeah. Early in the novel, there are a couple of related scenes. The family is moving across country from Oakland to Princeton.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, what a switch in culture
right. That
would be. And little Bernie and Emma's father is going to be a professor in Princeton.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting, they don't make a beeline for New Jersey, but as Emma says, they're zigzagging up and down America. It's for their education. That's important to their father.
Right.
Along the way, they stop. One of the places they stop at is Mount Rushmore. And then not too much later, they're in Arkansas at a Bob's Big Boy.
Mm-hmm.
Would you tell us what the two children experience here early in the novel?
Right. This section of the book, which is from Bernie and me in the first chapter, the road trip across the country, is the section that I always choose to read from when I do readings. And it was my stab at, you know that song from South Pacific, You've Got to Be Taught?
Mm-hmm.
To hate and fear, et cetera. You've got to be carefully taught about race. It's not, we don't really come into the world aware of what race we are. And so Emma's young enough during this road trip they're taking, I think she's six at that point, not to really be cognizant of the fact that her family is different or is going to be looked at as different and responded to in ways that that are hostile. So they arrive at this Bob's Big Boy to eat lunch in Arkansas, and everybody else, all the other customers in the restaurant, refuse to eat. They just stare at the family, and they all stop eating, and there's this silence, this hush that comes over the restaurant that feels really hostile, and Emma doesn't understand it, and she begins to feel both frightened and uncomfortable and sad, like she wants to cry. And I think the mother suggests that they leave, and BJ says no. Well, we always stay, sort of as a statement. So they stay, but the waitress won't come to serve them. And time is ticking very slowly, and it's sort of a horrible moment that stretches on. And then Bernie, Emma's brother, who's seven at this point in the story, gets down from his chair, and as Emma says, he turns into Michael Jackson and starts to do the moonwalk on Bob's Big Boy's black and white floor. So he sort of has this lightheartedness that Professor Lester has, that he's able to have a kind of a sense of humor about the look that they're receiving. And he feels, well, if I'm getting all of his attention, I may as well be a showman about it, which I think is actually kind of a beautiful way to respond and a brave way to respond. But it makes the father very angry. And he tells him to quit acting like a fool and ends up storming out of the restaurant and leaving Lynn and the two children there. And they wind up getting up and leaving as well. And Lynn leaves a tip on the table, even though they haven't eaten anything.
Hmm. And then a little while later in the story, Bernie and Emma take that experience and turn it upside down. Little Bernie wakes his sister up. They're in a Motel 6, mm-hmm. and tells her a story, a dream that he's had. Do you have the book there in front of you? Could you go to page 7, and do you know where I'm? It's about halfway down, I think. It's just a wonderful scene where these two kids are so close to one another, and here they've had quite a day.
Right.
And they're doing with it what they can.
There's this kid, Johnny, and his sister, Raisa. Bernie wakes me up to tell me at a Motel 6 while our parents are fast asleep in the next bed. This kid, Johnny, has a hole in his pocket. I don't mean a hole in his pocket like what a quarter falls through, but like a black hole from outer space that's rolled up in a ball and sitting in his pocket, sort of like it's a marble, only it's a black hole, understand? Yes, I say, even though I don't. So when they need to get away, Johnny takes the ball out of his pocket and throws it on the ground, and it turns into a hole. Then him and Raisa can jump in and get away. Only one time they jumped in, and they ended up on the other side of the world. But it's not China. It's this country where it's only giants that live there. Good giants or bad giants? Dumb giants. Oh. And Johnny made a serious mistake. He forgot to put the hole back in his pocket for them to get back. He lost it, so they're stuck there. Forever? Yes. Bernie rolls over so his back is to me. Go back to sleep. I dream about the Giants, and I tell Bernie about it when I wake up. He says, what were their names? And I say, Rushmore Fishmore and Bob's Big Boy. Bernie smiles at me and says, we had the same dream.
That's lovely.
Thank you.
And Rushmore Fishmore goes back to earlier, a little bit earlier in the story, before Bob's Big Boy, where they're at Mount Rushmore.
Right.
And that's a little weird, too.
Mm-hmm.
That's where we get the Giants from.
Mm-hmm.
You know, stone Giants, dumb Giants.
Right, right.
You know, at least that's how the kids experience.
Yeah.
Dreams of children, the dreams children have, their stories. Do you feel a closeness to that, to that part of your childhood, to children?
Yeah, I do. Very much so. So this book was, I guess it turned out kind of to be a coming-of-age story. And for the most part, the coming-of-age for Emma happens after Bernie's accident. So she kind of goes from 18 to 25. But I kept finding myself going back in time to her childhood and Bernie's childhood, this kind of beautiful time. And again, I felt really drawn to going back to the childhood of the father, to the time when he was BJ, growing up in Mississippi in the South at the age of, I guess he's, 12 or something, around that time. And the story also, in his youth, becomes the story of him and his uncle, who is actually only a few months older. That's Uncle Luscious. And I don't know, there's something, I find it easier to write about children. And I'm not sure why. There's less complexity there, I guess, and the vision that they have about complex things can actually be very profound.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon is writer Emily Robiteau. She is the author of The Professor's Daughter. It's a novel, and it is her debut novel. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, we have a few more minutes remaining in the program. If you'd like to join the discussion, you're more than welcome. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. You have three brothers.
Mm-hmm.
Older, younger?
One is older, and two are younger. And as I said, none of them are in a coma.
Good.
So, yeah.
So you're in the middle then.
Yeah, I'm the second child.
What was your experience growing up of being the only girl?
I think I was a little bit spoiled being the only girl, and I was also kind of a tomboy. I didn't really play with dolls. And my older brother was, when I was very young, I looked up to him so much. He was my
Is that Charlie?
That's my oldest brother is Albert.
Okay.
And Charlie who's my second brother, he's a musician, and he's the one that Bernie is very loosely based upon. He sees the world. He's had some learning disabilities growing up, as does the character in the book. I felt like his vision of the world was very different from mine, and I was very shy. He was really not shy, and I got really good grades, and he got really atrocious grades, and he was tracked really differently. I grew up in Princeton, where the book takes place, and I actually read at my high school yesterday, and there was a young woman who was a student there was interviewing me for the school paper, asking me what my experience there was like, and I said, you know, it was very painful for me because Princeton's a very white bread town. It's also a very segregated town, and the high school was very segregated. So in the cafeteria there was the black table, the table where the black kids sat, and I didn't really have very many classes with those kids because I was very tracked. I was taking a lot of accelerated and AP classes, and and I felt very distanced from those kids, and that was hard for me because I felt internally connected with them, but externally I didn't look like them, and so that was kind of painful. While my brother Charlie is much darker skinned than me, it's sort of more apparent when you see him what his background is, and he was not really tracked because he was in a lot of remedial classes, so his experience growing up in Prince in the same town was kind of different from mine because he was able to have black friends in a way that I wasn't really. So that kind of difference in terms of their experiences in the world was something I was interested in portraying in the book. You could come from the same family, but experience being black in different ways.
Mm. Bernie, the character in the book, is so bright, even though he has his learning disabilities, although it's clear he has different abilities.
Right.
And, you know, he says things that are quite stunning, and you highlight for the reader his insights with what the protagonist, the narrator, Emma, calls Bernieisms.
Mm-hmm.
And the very first one in the book is how the novel begins.
Right.
Bernieism 18:1. It is a privilege to be able to invent oneself. It is also a burden.
Right. Yeah, and then the book kind of examines that idea, I think. You know, that was the first thing that I wrote in graduate school. That was the first line of that story, the first line of the first story that I wrote. And I don't really think I knew what I was driving at when I wrote it. So the book kind of became an exploration of that idea, that it is both a privilege to be a blank slate, to be a racial blank slate in a way, and a burden.
But that's the work of life for everyone, or it should
for
be.
For everybody.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Not just somebody who's biracial and right. doesn't feel like they fit in, but for everyone. So I hope that this book...
It should have a wide readership.
That's what I was about to say. I hope that it does, because to me it doesn't feel like a quote-unquote black book. Unfortunately, it's being marketed that way. It's, if you go to Borders, you will find it not shelved under new fiction or under fiction/literature, but in the African-American interest section, which is troubling to me because... typically, the only people who shop in that section are black, which cuts down my potential readership to about 12%, which is the population.
Yeah.
I don't want to sound incredibly mercenary complaining about the fact that my book isn't getting the exposure it deserves, but I feel very angry, incensed actually, for all of the people who are ghettoized to that section, all of the authors who are, including Toni Morrison, who won the Nobel Prize.
What does that say about... And I know some people who work in bookstores in our community, and they're very good and they're very bright, and I don't think they do that. But we had a guest yesterday who said his book was pigeonholed in fiction when it's not a fictional story.
Right.
You know, so it kind of makes you wonder who's in the store, where are the directives coming from?
Mm-hmm.
How does something wind up where it shouldn't be?
Right.
Or how do we in a bookstore of all places,
right?
You know, come to have all these wacky categories.
Right. Well, I actually, when I was on my book tour, I landed in San Francisco, and I went to the Borders, which was not where I was reading, but I'd been hearing stories from family and friends about not being able to locate my book. So I went to Borders, and I found my book in the African-American interest section. I brought it to the information desk, and I said to the young man standing there, just out of curiosity, how is it that you make decisions about where to shelve books? And he said, we don't make those decisions. They make those decisions at headquarters back east. And so he said, but to tell you the truth, sometimes their designations are really off. And I said, oh, that was the case with my book, which just came out. And I showed it to him. And I said, believe it or not, this is being shelved in African American interest. So he looked at me and saw, a white face. And he said, how awful for you. And then, poor kid, I sort of was, I don't know, he became the target when really he's just following orders. But he gave me the phone number to call the headquarters, and I feel like if I did call it, it would be hard to find a person to speak with, because these sorts of decisions are usually institutional. Not, you can't find an individual who's made that decision. But I don't really believe that that section should exist, because there's not a Caucasian interest section. And if it does have to exist, it would be nice to be cross-referenced
yeah.
in both places.
Why can't it be in both places?
Right.
Because some books, they do need to be in more than one place.
That's true.
You know?
Yeah.
Well, maybe we need a little guerrilla action.
Yeah, maybe so.
Just move those books around yourself.
Yeah, that's right.
We're out of time. It's just been a delight talking with you this afternoon.
Oh, with you too, Celeste. Thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. My pleasure. Emily Robitaux has been our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. Her novel, The Professor's Daughter, is published by Henry Holt. Go to your bookstore and ask for it. This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. 8 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time. Settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason. And we're not making that connection with Todd at the moment, so what should we do? Let's see. Todd, are you there? No. Tell you what, Henry Frayne, my director friend, why don't you give me the numbers for the Mercantile Exchange, and I will read those, and if you would go and find out what has happened here this afternoon, that would be terrific. Okay, let's take a look at what happened today on the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. Livestock prices are largely lower today, and guess what? Todd is in the studio with me this afternoon, so I've given you a preview of what happened today on the Mercantile Exchange, but I know people are really interested in what happened on the board today, because it was a wild one.
Oh, it was a wild ride at the Chicago Board of Trade. I'm not sure exactly where we finished up. It was tougher technically up there, I think, than it has been here in the studio trying to get on the air. It was a rough day there at the Chicago Board of Trade, depending on which side of the market you're on. There's always a winner and always a loser, and today there were a lot of both. The bean pit up anywhere between a dime and the far deferred November's. The March contract up 23.5 cents. I was taking a look at the charts before I came in the studio here. The next stop looks to me like on the upside would be way back around $7.12. That was a high the last week of August in the lead option. And that's a pretty good jump from where we are in the nearby May contract, 662.5. The March corn or March soybeans at 656.75 on their settlement price. We'll talk all about that during the closing market report with Mike Zuzulo this afternoon. He, of course, is with Risk Management Commodities out of Lafayette, Indiana. Let's take a complete look at what happened at the Board of Trade. Futures in the corn, the wheat, the beans, all higher following the beans up. Fund buying was the big push for the day, and we'll take a look at the commitment of traders. That would have been a report that was as of Tuesday last week to see where they are. They've certainly added to their positions at this point. May, or rather March wheat for the day, 11.5 cents higher. They had a settlement price at 351.5 with a high at 353.5 and a low at 344. The May contract at 360.5 high, low at 347, settled there at $3.58. They were up a dime for the day. And July futures, 367, the high, the low at 353.5, settled 366, up 11. September futures in the wheat pit, 371, the high, the low at 360, settled 370.25. They were up a dime in the December futures, 380, the high, the low at 68, settlement price at $3.78 a bushel. They were up a dime as well. From the corn pit, nearby March contract at 217.75, high, low at 212.25. Settlement price 217.5, just a quarter cent off the high for the day. A nickel higher. The May futures settled 4.75 higher at 224.75 with a high of 225 even, a low at $2.19.75 for the May contract. July futures 232.25 high, low at 227.25, settled 231.5, up 4.5 for the day. And the September contract, a 238 high, low at 233.75, settled 236.75. They were up 3.5 for the day. In December futures, that's your new crop, $2.46, the high, the low at 241. Dease corn settled 245 for the new crop, up 3.5 cents today. March futures up 3 for the new crop. This is the 06 contract, 251.25, the high, the low at 247.75, a settlement price at 250.25. March oats for the day, 175.75 the high, the low at a 75.5, and a settlement price at, up on that high at 75.75, a quarter higher. May oats settled 2.25 higher at 57.5. March soybeans now 660 the high. The low at 637. Settled 656.75, up 23.5 cents. May futures a 666 high. Low at 642, settled 662.5, up 23.25 for the day. And July soybeans 670.5 the high. The low at 646, settled 666.5. They're up 23.5 cents. And the August contract a 670 high, low at 647. Settled 663.5, up 22.5 cents. September futures 650 and a half the high, the low at 632. Settled 649. They were up 19.25. And the November's in the bean pit, $6.38 the high, the low at 626. Settled $6.34.5 a bushel. They were up a dime as well. Bean meal, the March contract, 196.50 the high, the low at 187 even. Settled 196, up 10.90. And the May meal, 199 the high, the low at 189.80. Settled 198.10, they were up 9.30. And the March bean oil, 24.13 the high, the low at 23.65. Settled 23.96, they were up 41. And the May bean oil, up 38 cents, 24.35 the high, the low at 23.71. And the settlement price for the May bean oil, $24.04. They were up 38 for the day. Now here's Celeste Quinn with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange.
Okay, here we go. March feeder cattle, 105.35, the high 104.05, the low finishing at 104.90, down 65. April, 104.70, the high 103.10, the low 103.92.5, the settlement, that down 145. May, 104.10, the high 102.42.5, the low, the settlement 103.50, that down 130. April live cattle, 90.50, the high 88.85, the low, the settlement 89.10, that down 160. June 86.30, the high 84.95, the low 85.85, the settlement, that down 87.5. April lean hog 73.10, the high 72 even, the low 72.37.5, the settlement, that down 20. May 77.75, the high 75.70, the low 77.75, the settlement, that up $2. June lean hogs 80.90, the high 78.40, the low 80.75, the settlement, that up 182.5. July 78.20, the high 76.20, the low finishing at 78.12.5, up 145. And March bellies 88.20, the high 87.40, the low 88 even, the settlement, that up 250. And let's take a look at the markets on Wall Street. The Dow is off 64 points, the NASDAQ down 17, the S&P 500 down 8, and those are delayed by a few minutes.
The Carl Center for Rural Health and Farm Safety is proud to underwrite agricultural programming on WILL. The center helps residents of rural communities with education and training in farm safety. For more information, call 217-383-4606.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Jenna from the United Kingdom writes, "Dear Dr. Science, why does the color of a flame change when different chemicals are applied?"